number 96-0908, Angela McAvoy versus GHC of Eau Claire. Representing the defendant respondent petitioner is John P. Ritchie. Mr. Ritchie, are you ready?
May it please the court, my name is John Ritchie. I represent Group Health Cooperative of Eau Claire. Group Health Cooperative is a nonprofit cooperative organized under Chapter 185 of the Wisconsin statutes to provide a health care plan. Group Health owns its own clinics in Eau Claire, and it has its physicians on salary who work in those clinics in Eau Claire providing the health care through its own plan. Group Health provides the majority of its services through the doctors on staff at its own clinics. When a condition arises that a patient has an ailment which they cannot treat in their own facility, they often refer to other providers starting in the Eau Claire area, and if necessary, they usually go up to the Twin Cities. Subscribers to the Group Health Plan, as with most health maintenance organizations, have certain benefits and certain restrictions or limitations when they join up with an HMO. They do enjoy usually better rates when they start with an HMO, but they've given up certain freedoms of choice that they may have had before. When a person joins with Group Health, they no longer can go to the Mayo Clinic to receive their treatment. They're going to have to receive it from the Group Health physicians in Eau Claire. They can't go to Middleburg, which is the other major clinic in the Eau Claire area. They cannot go to the University of Minnesota. They must come to the Group Health and be seen by the Group Health physicians. Now, in this case, it involves the care and treatment of Angela McAvoy, a 13-year-old girl who at that time suffered from anorexia nervosa, an eating disorder. She was originally seen and treated by the Group Health physician starting in September of 1991 for that eating condition, where she was treated clinically as an outpatient at the Group Health clinics. From September of 91 through November of 91, she was treated as an outpatient. In November of 1991, Group Health decided that she should be treated as an inpatient. Since they didn't have inpatient treatment facilities available, they sent her over to the University of Minnesota and had her admitted over there. In January of 92, they went back and treated her again as an outpatient, where she was followed clinically with other healthcare professionals around the city of Eau Claire. In February, Group Health again went back and treated her as an inpatient because they were not happy with how the outpatient program had come along. McAvoy's have eventually brought suit, alleging that the care and treatment that was provided in January of 92 through February of 92, which is when they had opted to switch from inpatient care back to an outpatient program, alleging that that was an inappropriate treatment plan, and that the appropriate treatment plan was that this particular condition should be treated with inpatient hospitalization. They claim that the out-treatment program that was set up by Dr. Stuart Lancer, who was the medical director of Group Health at the time, was insufficient and have gone on with various citations about how it was a suboptimal program and that it was ill-suited for this particular condition. The way they have framed the issue is that she was denied benefits as an inpatient because Group Health treated her as an outpatient. Group Health did not treat her as an inpatient because, in their opinion, it was not necessary to be treated as an outpatient basis. So the issue now is that a medical malpractice claim against the Group Health and its physicians in failing to provide appropriate medical care for this condition? Or can Group Health, which is a cooperative, be sued as an insurance company under an insurance bad faith claim, saying if you had referred me for inpatient hospitalization, it would have been covered? Since you didn't refer me, obviously it was not covered.
Is Group Health also an insurance company, and it doesn't make any difference?
It is not an insurance company. It's a cooperative.
Is it authorized to sell any insurance?
No.
Does it make any difference that it might hold itself out as an insurance company, like in the phone book listed under insurance?
I'm sorry, I can't understand you. Could you just say it again?
I have... In the yellow pages, Group Health is listed under insurance. Does that make any difference to the analysis if it holds itself out as an insurance company?
I don't think so. I think that probably the telephone people probably listed in an area where most people are likely to look. And that if you were listed under cooperatives, it would never get found.
If it has an ad placed in the under insurance, does that make any difference for the analysis?
I don't think it does under this analysis. If there was some claim that they had misrepresented themselves, maybe that would have some relevance. But the issue that we have in this case is more widespread than just how we'll deal with an anorexia eating disorder program, because this could really apply to anybody who walks in the door for a healthcare cooperative. If somebody comes in and says, I have a headache and I would like to be admitted to the hospital and have MRIs and CT scans, it's not likely that you're going to get it. But they could then turn and say, well, under the cooperative insurance certificate, those are covered benefits. You'd say, well, they're covered if we order them, but we're not ordering them. And just because you want them doesn't mean that we're going to order them.
Does it make any difference that this was not within the group itself, but it was an outside referral? In other words, at the time this took place, it was at the University University of Minnesota Hospital.
Right. I don't think that makes...
You think that does not make a difference?
No, it does not make any difference, because group health has... the requirement to make services available. Whether they do it in their own facilities is great for them, but if they don't have it in their own facilities, they still have a duty to make it available to the people who have paid those premiums.
Well, she was being treated at the time that Dr. Lancer made the decision to terminate or not to expend any further funds by an outside organization. That's why I asked that question, because that's where the treatment was taking place.
That's right. He had ordered that.
Yes. But he also ordered it not to continue.
That's exactly. He had essentially switched the treatment program. He's the one who decided she should be treated as an inpatient in the first place. He's the one who then was unhappy with the inpatient treatment and established the outpatient treatment program.
Mr. Ritchie, let me follow up on Justice Wilcox's question, if I'm right. In your brief at page 16, you cite to section 655.002, paren F. And part of your argument, as I understand it, is that chapter 655 is what's applicable here, that bad faith, the Anderson case, is not applicable. And yet the language in 655.002, paren F, specifically under applicability, talks about services being provided, and let me just read it, a cooperative sickness care association organized under section 185.981 to 185.985 that operates a nonprofit sickness care plan in this state and that directly provides services through salaried employees in its own facility. Now, isn't that significant that in this particular case, what's at issue was being provided in a different facility, not the facility of the HMO?
Well, I expected that that question would come up. I think that there's two ways to look at that. First off is that I think they're defining what HMOs we're talking about. Group health does, in fact, have its own facilities and employs its people on salary. It doesn't say that it only applies while they are providing services in their own facilities. It just applies to those cooperatives that have their own facilities. But the second way to look at that is that the treatment program, they're not unhappy. The plaintiffs were not unhappy with the treatment program at the University of Minnesota. It's that they switched it and brought her back to Eau Claire and started treating her in their own facility again, which they're unhappy with. So it's the second phase of that treatment, so to speak, where she went back to being an outpatient. She was being an outpatient. The course of the outpatient, that's what they do not like, is the outpatient treatment plan. But the outpatient treatment plan was her being seen clinically in the group health clinic in Eau Claire. Okay, now there were also some other professionals that were brought in, some healthcare, psychiatric counselors, that sort of thing. But it's the very fact that she was being seen in clinic by some salaried people that they are unhappy with.
Well, weren't they also unhappy about the fact that the young woman involved was in an inpatient facility at the University of Minnesota Hospitals and then was pulled out halfway through that treatment?
Yes.
And then put in the outpatient program?
Right, but the claim doesn't arise from the treatment in Minnesota. It arises from the treatment here in Wisconsin.
But it also arises, does it not, from an administrative type of decision that was made to terminate the treatment that was originally approved in Minnesota or for Minnesota facilities?
That's how claimants have looked at it, yes.
Well, let me ask you, because it seems to me that this is a difficult area. You would agree that if we had what we call a regular insurance company that authorized up to a 1 week stay in the hospital for some kind of procedure, and a patient went in the hospital, and after 3 days, the insurance company decides, for economic reasons, they don't want to pay for more than 3 days for that patient, despite the fact that the doctor believes that it's necessary for the care of the patient, and the insurance company calls up the patient and said, you're on your own for the rest of the week, we're not going to pay, that insurance company, in fact, could be liable, depending on what happened, for bad faith.
Yes.
The problem I have with your case is that it's a little bit of mixing the two, and I think you probably admit this. We've got economic decisions clearly and a decision to terminate the payment to the University of Minnesota on behalf of the plaintiff, and your argument is that it was a medical decision, but I guess I'd like you to address this lap over, and where is the line between the two? Because the referral was made to the University of Minnesota. The doctor was treating her there. In fact, as I understand it from the record, discharged her against his medical advice because he believed she needed ongoing treatment. And it certainly, at least in the allegation stage, looks like a financial decision by, just like an insurance company, although I know you argue this isn't an insurance company, an economic decision saying she doesn't need this full inpatient anymore, so we're not going to pay it anymore. If she wants to stay, I assume they would have let her stay. They didn't have any control over her. But they aren't going to pay for it anymore, and if she wanted to have treatment, she had to then go outpatient. And that decision looks a lot like an insurance company kind of decision as opposed to a medical one. So I guess my long question is, where are the lines on this, and why shouldn't there be some liability on behalf of an HMO for bad faith?
The way I walk through that is to just start with the wording of Chapter 655. First of all, the very fact that a healthcare cooperative is listed under 655.002 sub F, it refers to a cooperative sickness care association. So they are a party who can be brought in under this chapter. So that our legislatures, first of all...
Well, I don't think the plaintiff is contesting that they could be on medical decisions. So,
well, the next thing is when you skip down to 655.007, any patient who has a claim for bodily injury on account of malpractice. Now, the plaintiff in this case did, in fact, allege a bodily injury. And the question here is, on this statute, is it on account of malpractice? Malpractice is not defined anywhere in the statute. Okay, but that is sort of a generic term for decisions made by a healthcare provider in the care and treatment that you are going to provide to a particular patient. Now, in this case, Dr. Lancer and Group Health are making decisions about the care and treatment provided to Angela McAvoy. They decided to treat her as an outpatient. It's not just an insurance company saying, we will pay or we will not pay. This is a physician.
But is this a physician that's treating her on a daily basis that's her primary? Isn't it just the director of the HMO, and in fact her primary physician is treating her so she has to stay in?
At least that's
the allegation.
I don't think that makes any difference. The fact that you are not the primary day-to-day physician certainly does not relieve you from liability that arises from the medical decisions that may be made.
So I'm sorry, I'm going to ask one follow-up question. Is there any evidence that this director was examining her and interviewing her and to make these decisions?
He did not examine her face-to-face or talk to her face-to-face. But then neither does any pathologist or radiologist typically, but they get sued right and left because of they provide health. I mean,
This is a psychological psychiatric case as opposed to reading slides that everybody can look at, is it not?
Yes, and that's why he set up a program that would include psychiatric services being provided either in his facility or with others under contract.
Counsel, you seem to be arguing to me, both here and in your briefs, that in this case, this was a medical decision.
Yes.
And that may well be the case. But we're being asked to decide whether or not the tort of bad faith can ever lie. Now, is it your position that a decision of a medical director to withhold referral can never be done in bad faith?
My position is that's the same as any doctor.
What if the medical director were to admit
that the decision was based upon economic consequences and not upon medical.
I don't think that would make any difference.
So you don't think these decisions, even if they're totally economic, ever amount to bad faith?
No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is I don't think you can sue a medical person because he's still, under this chapter, he's still making a decision that deals with the...
Well, who's the medical person? Here they're suing Group Health Cooperative, right?
Right.
So you're saying, if I push Justice Babbage's hypothetical, you're saying they can never sue Group Health Cooperative of Eau Claire if Dr. was it Lancer?
Yes.
If Dr. Lancer says, puts on the patient's record, you put in too much money already on this patient, much more than the premium, this is a loser, get her out of there and treat her here, and I don't care about the medical stuff so much because economically we got to lose her. Right? That's your hypothetical.
Exactly. See, now what you're getting at is people who do things with ill will.
Well, okay, but is it medical malpractice?
I think that is medical malpractice.
Okay, so is it anything else? Is it a violation of the insurance concept of bad faith?
I don't think you can bring it within the insurance concept.
So your answer to Justice Babbage then is you can never sue the cooperative or any member thereof, medical member thereof, for bad faith.
Right.
Even if it's malice.
What about the financial person in that works for the medical group, the cooperative, that signs off and says, we're not going to pay for this, but it's made up the way this company is made up?
Well, the way this company is made up is that the doctors come under the umbrella of the medical director, and then the CEO is in charge of other business-related matters with filings with the insurance.
That's how this is set up. Let's assume some company, they all defer to the financial person in the company.
Or if this guy didn't have a doctor at the
yes,
so
no, that's right. The Lancer doesn't have to be a doctor to be the chief guy here. And Lancer writes a note to the doctor, the end.
We're not paying for anything.
Not paying for anyone.
First of all, I think I would imagine then when they do bring a medical malpractice claim against Group Health, they would get ripped up and down for having somebody who's not a doctor make those kinds of decisions.
Well, the doctor does make the decision ultimately here, whether it's Lancer or the treating doctor. The doctor says out. I mean, but the question is there, no matter how you set it up, is there a way of getting a bad faith? And the way I hear you, it's no.
Right.
Everything is a medical decision.
You see, under Chapter 6, even under Chapter 655.005, it talks about the employees of a health care provider, where any person having a claim against a health care provider for damage or bodily injury or death due to acts or omissions of the employee of the health care provider acting within the scope of his or her employment.
Well, suppose the janitor hit somebody in the office.
He's not acting within the... I didn't finish the sentence.
Okay.
Acting within your employment and providing health care services.
Okay.
The janitor is not providing health care services.
So he doesn't cover everything. You keep looking at 655. Why don't we look at 609?
Okay.
And is it, does Group Health Cooperative Eau Claire, does it have a certificate of authority from the Commissioner of Insurance?
Well, I don't know. I assume they probably do.
Yeah, under 609.03, I think they do. I mean, the way I read it, I'm not an expert in that area. But so they have a certificate by the insurance commissioner. One would assume that they have a commissioner's certificate, and if they've come under these provisions, that they look like an insurance company. They smell like an insurance company. Just as Babbage would say, they walk like an insurance company, talk like an insurance company. They are an insurance company.
The other way to look at that is to say,
it's not a rose.
Is to say that you have a duty to provide and make available medical services. And so we are making available the services which we deem to be appropriate, which for a while we thought inpatient care was appropriate, but now we do not deem that appropriate. We deem that to be inappropriate. And the claim is that, gee, the medical care that you provided was below the standard of care which should be provided, which smells like a malpractice claim and walks like a malpractice claim and seems to fit within all...
The problem with that is it inappropriate to pay for the medical treatment, or is the medical treatment itself inappropriate? And I think those are two separate issues. An insurance company decides they're not going to pay for it anymore. They don't make it a judgment as to whether or not some doctor thinks it may be medically necessary. For whatever reason, they're not going to pay for it. And at least the allegations here are that that was the decision that was here, that it, because the doctor that was treating her said she needed more treatment.
Well, an important point, though, on that is that the patient here has no right to be at the University of Minnesota unless group health sends her there.
I mean, just and medically necessary?
Well, if group health sends her there, it's going to be covered no matter what, just the same as if she had decided to go to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester saying inpatient care is necessary. You'd say, well, look, we didn't refer you there. We have to refer you in order for it to be covered.
Counsel, can you finish with that question? I don't want to interrupt.
I lost my train of thought, so I guess I did.
I want to give you a hypothetical. Assume that there's a HMO called NCHPP. Assume, unlike your HMO, they don't have doctors on staff, but they contract with different independent service providers, independent clinics. Assume that 5 years ago they said, in order to maximize the dollar on this HMO, we should hire a medical director. And he's going to really help us in cost containment. Is it your position that, and before they hired this medical director 5 years ago, they had an assistant vice president of claims who had nothing to do with medicine that was making these decisions? Is it your position that prior to hiring the medical director that they would be subject to bad faith, and after hiring the medical director for cost containment purposes, and he's speaks their language, the medical language, that they can only be subject to malpractice? Is that your position?
Well, first of all, I don't think that would come within the chapter 655 because they wouldn't have fit within the category of healthcare providers that are covered under that category.
Second,
chapter 655 applies to bodily injury claims.
Well, hold on. Do all HMO cooperative health plans that are registered under the state of Wisconsin, is it your position that only HMOs that have doctors on staff must be sued under malpractice and can't be subject to bad faith? Are you dividing HMOs that way? Are you saying all HMOs?
I'm saying cooperatives that have them on staff come within the definition. If there is a different framework, I'd have to look through the statute to see if they fit within a different framework. They could be sued, but the question is, can you sue them breach of contract or bad faith as an
insurance? What if a health maintenance organization had two doctors on staff and contracted with 55 independent providers? And those providers, of course, had contracts with NCHPP and WPS and Greater Marshfield and all of those folks. Would two on staff be able to keep them out of the arena of bad faith?
Well, first of all, getting the arena of bad faith, my argument is that the arena of bad faith only applies to an insurance company. And since you're not an insurance company, you're not in the arena of bad faith to begin with.
Well, but what about companies like your client who advertise in the Yellow Pages as an insurance company? I mean, how can you stand here and say you're not an insurance company when you hold yourself out as an insurance company?
Because we provide medical services. Insurance companies just indemnify you for medical expenses that you incur wherever you choose to go. So there is a fundamental difference between an insurance company indemnifying for the medical expenses and our obligation to provide the medical services.
Well, Mr. Ritchie, are you here, Justice Fadler?
Yes.
I discern a fundamental difference. I'm going to ask you whether you agree with me. I discern a fundamental difference between a doctor who says, I didn't perform such and such a medical service because at the time I did not believe that the exigencies demanded it, even though now I know I should have and I was negligent. but I didn't intentionally deny them. I simply was negligent. Seems to me there's a big difference between that doctor and another doctor who says, I denied medical services even though I knew there was no reasonable basis for doing so. In other words, I intentionally denied reasonable medical services. And that, to me, seems to be the dividing point between medical mal and bad faith. Now, do you discern the same difference that I do or no?
Well, I know the difference that you're talking about, but that difference can apply to every kind of situation, even excluding the medical world.
Ah, but no, not when, because not every situation has the type of fiduciary relationship that exists between the healthcare provider, in this case GH, and the healthcare recipient. Because the healthcare recipient, just like an insured, has no choice.
See, can I answer your question?
Please.
In my opinion, that's not a fiduciary relationship. It's a doctor-patient relationship. The doctor-patient relationship is an important one by all means of how you want to put it, but it is not a fiduciary. Doctors have never been considered fiduciaries for the patients. They are there to figure out the problem and try and fix it, just the same as many other important relationships are.
We didn't have HMOs 15 years ago either.
Well, I think we had them at least 15 years ago.
Well, I mean to the extent, of course.
Thank you, Mr. Ritchie. You'll get another 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Biegert?
Yes.
Mr. Biegert, we represent Angela M. McAvoy.
Thank you, Your Honor. I am Matthew Biegert. I am the lawyer for Angela and Susan McAvoy. Before I address the specific legal issues, let me address for 2 minutes the backdrop against which this case is being litigated. We're moving to a managed care environment. We can debate whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but that's the fact. And all of us, I think, hear at least anecdotal evidence that there are certain problems associated with managed care in general and with HMOs in particular. Since the time this court accepted this case, I was looking at news magazines and newspapers and trying to cut out articles on this, and I stopped the project. I mean, there is a lot of things going on there that people are concerned about and people don't necessarily like. This morning, when I got up, Wisconsin Public Radio was on talking about another room in this building where they're debating passing a law requiring 48-hour stays in hospitals for mastectomy patients because they were getting booted out quicker than that. And they had the HMO PR person on, and they're saying, well, that's not our responsibility. That's the responsibility of the doctor or patient. We don't discharge these people. But the fact is, as you see in this case, they have leverage with these third-party providers. They can threaten not to pay, and they can threaten not to refer more patients. And that's why I think it's important that when we look at this, we look at what purpose bad faith serves in this kind of environment and why it's different than medical malpractice and why it's needed. Reason number one, attorney's fees can be recovered. If you have a $5,000 procedure, who is going to not pay $5,000 to have that procedure done out of their own pocket rather than pay a lawyer the same amount when they're not even guaranteed they're going to get reimbursed? Attorney's fees are important. Punitive damages are important. In a case where there is a willful disregard of paying these benefits and providing these services under the contract, we need this to help control what these providers do. And finally, medical malpractice is very expensive, it's complex, it's expert-driven, more so than a bad faith claim. So for these reasons, I think public policy supports having a bad faith claim in this situation. Now, against this background, let's look at what we have in this specific case, and let's look at the legal issue. Let's first look at preclusion under Chapter 655, because if there's preclusion there, that's the end of the story. We don't have to look at whether there'd be a bad faith claim in the absence of preclusion. And what we have here are these facts related to the issue of the denial of benefits. We have Group Health admitting Angela McAvoy to the University of Minnesota treatment plan in November of 1991. We have Dr. Lancer, who is primarily an administrative doctor who doesn't have any expertise in this area. In fact, there is nobody on the Group Health staff with any expertise in treating any mental health disorders. This is apparently the first anorexia case Group Health has ever had. And Dr. Lancer has never seen Angela McAvoy, never treated Angela McAvoy. They do some monitoring. As I read the records, and the records are attached to the affidavits and summary judgment, that consisted of Dr. Lancer calling over to the University of Minnesota, I believe once, and his assistant, Diane Vinopal, who has a high school education, calling over there about five or six times.
I'm going to interrupt you just for a
sure.
moment, because as you go through this, I want you don't have to answer it now if you don't want it. It builds into your argument later, but I'd like you to explain to me how, if we accept your position, which certainly has some appeal in this case, we can avoid a problem that every decision, medical decision, that a provider in an HMO, so a doctor treating a patient, who makes a decision not to order a procedure or a treatment, is not going to not only be sued under Chapter 655, but also be sued for bad faith. And the argument being by an alleged injured plaintiff being that it was an economic decision versus a medical decision. So I just want to, you don't have to address it now if it doesn't fit, but I can tell you that that's one of my concerns, that we don't start looking at each medical decision and having an argument side by side that in fact it was an economic decision. And I don't know how you sort of shift out the economic decisions and the medical decisions.
Let me quickly run through the facts here and then I'll jump right on that question. Remainder of the facts that I think are applicable. In making his decision, Dr. Lancer didn't talk to anybody else on the group health staff or outside the group health staff as to what was medically necessary, didn't consult with any treatises, didn't look at any protocols, and in fact, you'll see the note in the Court of Appeals decision, he refused to talk to the treating doctors. He said, no, stop payment. I'm not even going to talk to these people anymore. No extensions. Upon discharge, the McAvoys wanted her placed in a structured inpatient or outpatient program in Eau Claire. They refused to do that. They had her in systems counseling, which had nobody with any expertise. They had her in a group therapy for overeaters. And it was abominable how the treatment they provided to this woman, what they were willing to pay for as opposed to what was appropriate. The only factor that is apparent from the record at this point is cost. The cost of having somebody in a hospital in the Twin Cities full-time as opposed to somebody going to one group session and one counseling session a week. So that's the facts. Now here's the statutes. Statutes are 655. 655 applies to group health. No question about that in my mind. But not everything group health does is governed by 655, because 655.007 specifically says that only malpractice claims are subject to the preemptive positions of 655 and need to be brought under those procedures. Is this a malpractice claim? No, it certainly isn't pled as one. Are we dealing here with treatment or diagnosis? Not really. What we're dealing with is whether that inpatient treatment is going to be paid for. As you can see from her second stay, because she did go back in late February, in March, group health told her the benefits had run out, but she continued to stay there. Group health didn't pay for it. And group health had no say in what medical treatment she got other than providing the money for it. They couldn't force the University of Minnesota to discharge her. She could stay if she wanted to, but in this case, they cut off the funds.
And Mr. Meager, you were referring to the pleadings. Didn't you also, in the pleadings in this case, allege that there was bodily injury on the part of Ms. McAvoy?
No question about it. One of the things that we allege is had they not pulled her out when they did, a relapse would not have occurred or would have been substantially less likely to occur.
Doesn't that sound to you like medical malpractice, like a Chapter 655 claim?
You can't determine medical malpractice by what the result is. You have to look at the act and whether the act is a case of medical malpractice. In this case, the act from which the bodily injury flows is the act of denying payment or denying benefits for continued inpatient treatment over the University of Minnesota. That's the act we're concerned about.
But that act could be malpractice and not bad faith. One of the doctors and 10 archbishops all agree that the doctor's decision, although the wrong decision, was made in good faith.
If it's made in good faith, then they're going to win a bad faith case. For purposes of summary judgment in deciding whether a bad faith case can be brought, let me go to a Justice Gessler's question and say how I see how I analyze this. And let's make it very simple. In this case, you have Dr. McFarland, who is the treating pediatrician.
Well, I don't mind you going to this case, but I want you to set standards for us. If you were writing, if you could write the decision, what are the standards that would be used to analyze it at summary judgment?
Well, let me talk about how I think it plays out and then what the rule is. You have Dr. McFarland, who is a treating pediatrician. You have Dr. Lancer, who is making the decisions concerning coverage. And you have this patient here. Let's say in the first case, you simply have Dr. McFarland sees the patient, in his mind, sees no reason to refer to outpatient treatment, never talks to Dr. Lancer, never brings it up in terms of whether there should be a reference, and some harm results. Somebody alleges down the line that he should have spotted that, he should have known that they weren't competent to treat it there, and there should have been some referral. I think in that case, you have a case of medical malpractice.
But if he should have ordered inpatient?
Correct. That he should have...
That's malpractice?
That's malpractice. And the reason why is because I don't think you have a precondition to the bad faith case, which is an application for benefits.
If nobody is I missed what you
did. An application for benefits. If nobody has requested that group health provide something under their policy, under their coverage, you don't have a demand for benefits, and therefore I don't think you can have that.
I don't understand that point. You've got somebody going to an HMO, and the doctor should have sent somebody inpatient, and they didn't. That's a malpractice?
The doctor should have spotted and diagnosed the condition and determined that a referral was appropriate. That doctor's failure to bring to the attention of the person who can make a decision regarding referral is malpractice. Let's get second situation. Second situation is Susan McAvoy, mom comes and says, my daughter's getting worse and worse. I've heard about this treatment program. I think she should go to the cities until she gets better because she's not doing very well here. Dr. McFarland, her treating pediatrician, goes, you know, I don't really think she needs this. I think we can continue to monitor her and treat her right here. Dr. Lancer says, I agree. I'm denying, we're not going to pay any benefits for treatment over in Minnesota. In that case, I think you potentially have two causes of action because you have two separate acts. I think you have Dr. McFarland giving his medical opinion that referral wasn't necessary, and I think you have Dr. Lancer denying benefits. Now you're going to have a real tough case as a practical matter against Dr. Lancer because he would seem to have a good basis for denying those benefits and that the treating doctor said, you don't need to provide
them. Your position is he should get past summary judgment on the tort of bad faith. If the plaintiff makes an allegation that this is an economically based decision, under the facts scenario you just gave us, both claims should go to trial.
If both claims are brought, both claims should go to trial if there are facts which would tend to show that the decision by Dr. Lancer not to provide this inpatient treatment was unreasonable.
Now, suppose Dr. McFarland, in your example, says, hey, I'm not going to refer because maybe it would be better, but I'm going to take the chance, and I don't want to refer because it's going to decrease my bonus at the end of the year. I'm going to cut the costs by keeping them in.
Problem, and that you run into there is simply that if Dr. McFarland makes a decision for whatever reason not to refer, but there hasn't been any demand, anyone asking, whether it be a treating doctor, whether it be mom, whether it be Angela, for the benefit, then I don't think it falls neatly under traditional bad faith claim.
So if you cut out Lancer, which was your second example, if you cut out Lancer, then you cut out the bad faith. Because all that I did to change your example was I pushed it into the doctor who's going to make both decisions that they're not going to refer, which is a mistaken decision medically, and they're not going to defer also because he doesn't want to run up the bill. because he gets a bonus at the end of this.
If an application, whether it be internal from Dr. McFarland to Dr. Lancer, whether it be from parent requesting, whether it be from the doctors at the University of Minnesota requesting, if the person who has the authority to make a call on referrals is never called upon to make that decision, then I think you don't have a bad faith case.
What I need you to do is give us our standards. I still need those standards. The standards I've heard you say is it could be both medical malpractice and bad faith. And to have a bad faith, it has to be at least an allegation that it was based on something other than medical reasons, and somebody had to actually demand it, and it was refused. Is that enough to get over? I need the standards so that we can please over the examples.
In the context of an HMO, like in the context of any other insurance company, there is an application for benefits, and those benefits are denied, then you have prima facie case of bad faith if you can show absence of...
Okay, so if I go to an HMO and I want to have an x-ray, and the doctor says, I don't know, I'm not going to order an x-ray, and I go to another doctor and say, I want to order an x-ray, and they say, sure, and I go back next to the HMO and said, I want you to pay for this, I now have both a medical malpractice claim, assuming it was malpractice, and a bad faith claim.
I'm not sure. You go to a doctor.
An HMO doctor. And he refuses to give me what I've asked for, an x-ray. I think I've got a broken arm and I want an x-ray. And he says no. He doesn't tell me, I don't think it's necessary.
Psychosomatic.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessary. And I say, I want it, and I want the HMO to pay for it. Now, do I have both a malpractice claim, assuming it was medical negligence and not ordering it, and a bad faith claim?
I think you have bad faith, potentially, in that they wouldn't pay for it. When you say he wouldn't provide it, you say he wouldn't provide it if you would pay for it. If that's the case, yeah, I think you got medical negligence there as well.
Both claims.
Counsel?
It seems your standard is really a demand for benefits. That's the difference, that's the cutting edge in all your examples, that either the treating doctor said, I want a referral, or the patient said, I want a referral. And unless you have either of those, you don't have, under your argument, if I've heard you right, you don't have a bad faith claim.
I believe that's correct.
And okay. That's your standard.
Egregious negligence, if a doctor fails to refer in a situation that it clearly should have, but unless somebody is asking them to pay for something, I don't think you have bad faith.
I don't think you're quite getting what we're getting at. You're sort of thinking like a trial lawyer right now, and we're asking you to think like an appellate judge. Because when we write this decision, at least for me, it's going to be pretty easy to say, well, if it's purely a medical decision, there's no bad faith. And if it's purely an economic decision, without any consideration of the medical things, I have no problem giving you bad faith. But where I've got the problem is between the two. Where does the medical malpractice spill over into bad faith? Is it on a scale of 1 to 10, is it at step 2 or step 4 or 7? And what is it that triggers the bad faith? And those are the kind of standards that I want, because if I've got to write this opinion, I'm going to have to say to the trial court, I'm going to have to give direction to the trial courts, look, when you're faced with a motion for summary judgment, or when you've got the case, it's gone for trial, if the following circumstance, you take into account the following circumstances in determining whether or not medical malpractice has spilled over into bad faith. And what are those factors that we should consider?
I think that, again, that factor is simple, and that factor is whether there has been a request for benefit to the HMO.
Okay.
I can't hear you.
Whether there has been a request for a benefit under the certificate or the policy to the HMO, which the HMO has not honored.
Does it make any difference that, because you say, when there's a request for a benefit, that frightens me. I mean, there can be requests for benefits to smoke weeds in Mexico that are denied, you know. Maybe it's more subtle than that. Maybe a request for benefits for treatment outside the plan.
I think that would be adequate.
Outside of what? Outside the contract.
Why? Request for benefit. I'm a stooge on the street. I don't understand what I need. I go in to see the doctor because I've got a pain in my left elbow, and the doctor says, okay, this is what you should do. So, and I say, okay, doc, I'll do it. I haven't made any request for a benefit. Yet the doctor in his oath, it seems to me that a claim for bad faith should lie against that doctor if the doctor knows at the time that he diagnosed my elbow that there was something else he should be doing, but solely for economic benefit to the HMO, he didn't order it. So I don't think your request for benefit test works under that situation. And yet I think if we're going to award bad faith, certainly it should.
Well, in a perfect world, I'd agree with that's what the law should be. I think Chapter 655 constrains us in those types of decisions from saying that those are bad faith decisions.
Well, let's assume that I have gone in, I have not requested the benefit, and the doctor has withheld referring me to Mayo Clinic solely because of economic considerations, even though he knows that he can't treat it, his HMO can't treat it. Are you saying that I shouldn't be able to sue him for tort of bad faith if I eventually find out what really went on?
I think that under those situations, you could probably... I think you can construe the request for the benefit as being... you run into a problem. If you construe the request for benefit so broadly as the benefit being appropriate treatment, and that's what you're entitled to under the policy, and you don't get appropriate treatment...
And every case is bad. I mean, this is the converse of the question asked opposing counsel. Can you have both, or is it an either-or? I mean, the court's asking you exactly the same question. They're just phrasing it now in terms of bad faith. I mean, the opposing counsel's position was you can only have medical malpractice. Your position is you can have both, but the court's pressing you. How do you divide it?
And let me shift gears and try another standard and give me a minute to develop it. Before you jump on me. A very easy standard. Any decision as to whether to refer to out-of-network providers is a decision which can be subject to bad faith law.
And that means everybody who has a malpractice has a potential bad faith. Because you can always argue that one aspect of a malpractice was failure to refer. I mean, that's okay. It's an okay decision. I mean, if that's what you think and if that's what the court buys.
And I guess the problem is the court is looking to weed out spurious claims before they're brought. And I guess my position would be...
I think what the court is trying to do, Mr. Biegert, is to make sure that not every medical malpractice claim is a bad faith claim.
And this would not have every medical malpractice claim be a bad faith claim because it would only deal with the referral to out-of-network providers. And let me buttress that by directing your attention to Section 655.002, paren 1, paren F. And that says, with regard to HMOs, that the only ones covered by medical malpractice are those that directly provide services through salaried employees at its facility. So what we're talking about here is we've got basically three different models of HMOs. We have a staff model, which we have here, which has some doctors on staff. We have a direct contract model, in which you've got doctors with employment contracts or with independent contractor contracts with the HMO, and you've got a group model where the HMO contracts with some clinic or something. It's clear that you're not going to have a malpractice claim if you've got the type of an HMO which has independent contractor relationships with its doctor, and you're not going to have medical malpractice if you have an HMO which has contracts with providers. You simply cannot have it under the statute. So if they're making the exact same decisions, we're not going to refer to this entity, we're not going to refer to this specialist, those are clearly going to be bad faith cases with all other HMOs other than a staff model HMO.
Bigger?
Yes.
What about a standard for determining bad faith such as follows? An intentional or reckless disregard of necessary medical treatment because of the economic consequences of such treatment. A bad faith tort will lie where there is an intentional or reckless disregard for the necessary medical treatment because of the economic consequences of that treatment.
And that refers then to referral or non-referral?
Yes, referral or non-referral, regardless of whether there's been a request or not.
The concern that I have about that is that it sets up HMOs as their own little fiefdom with different bad faith law applying to them in a higher or more difficult standard, apparently, at least just from my initial reading of those or listening to that sentence, of what is needed to prove bad faith against an HMO as opposed to proving bad faith against a health insurer or a liability insurer or someone else. I think that bad faith law as it exists in the state is dynamic enough that with the present bad faith law in a case-by-case situation, those concerns can be addressed.
Let me just ask you about the regular bad faith. Does the insured have to demand that the insurance company pay the claim or do the defense? I mean, suppose that I file a claim against my own insurance company and say, pay it, and they don't, so I don't write any other letter and I pay it myself, and then within the statute of limitations, I wake up and think, hey, that's not right. I read in the newspaper, the Supreme Court decision says they should have paid it. And so now I make a claim against them on bad faith. Is that okay?
No. And I think because when you say a claim, I'm not talking about some sort of technical legal term. I'm talking about some action which puts the insurance company on notice that they have a responsibility to either pay the benefit or investigate whether they need to pay the benefit.
Well, I did. I made a demand on them. But then I didn't follow through and do anything else with them. Is that enough?
On your part?
Yeah.
Yes. Let me get back quickly to what I was talking about, which is that under the way HMOs are structured, the only time you're going to have a medical malpractice claim is when somebody like Dr. McFarland is on the staff. If you take Dr. McFarland off that staff, even though he had nothing to do with making these decisions to pull the care at the University of Minnesota, you cannot have a medical malpractice claim. Because if you don't have the staff physicians providing treatment, you're not subject to Chapter 655. If you go back and look at Chapter 609, we look at the way insurance is regulated, you look at the fact that these people, this outfit has to procure a certificate of insurance and is governed by laws relating to insurance companies. Third-party out-of-network referrals are something that should be governed by bad faith law. And the easiest distinction to draw is that a decision to refer or not refer out of network is subject to bad faith if you can show bad faith criteria, that the decision was without a basis and that the insurance company, the HMO, knew or recklessly failed to assert it was without
a basis. Let me ask you, because I'm not clear. Are you still maintaining that there ought to be a request for a referral out? Because if not, in every case that there was treatment within the HMO and there's an alleged allegation of malpractice, there's going to be an allegation that there should have been a referral outside to more experts, you know, at Mayo or at one of the other. Is part of your component the fact that somebody requested a referral to some outside hospital or provider?
I've been enlightened, and I would now take the position that it is sufficient to ask for appropriate treatment under the terms of.
But isn't that a problem, though, that every time there's going to be a medical, I'm going to argue with you on the other side of that coin, then, when there's a medical malpractice claim against a physician within an HMO, and there's alleged malpractice, isn't there going to be a side-by-side claim that that physician was in over his or her head, and that he or she should have made a referral to some outside provider, and therefore there's an allegation of bad faith?
If that physician works for an entity which has the ability to make referrals and fund those referrals,
most HMOs do that, do they not?
Only those HMOs. The staff model HMO is not the primary HMO. Most HMOs have contracts with doctors or contracts with clinics rather than having their own employed physicians on staff. If you have the type of HMO with employed physicians on staff, but the ability to make a referral to out-of-network providers and pay for that referral, and if there's a failure to do so, and an allegation that that failure was made against the medical evidence and they knew or should have known, yeah, you're going to have two claims. You're going to leave the trial judges of the state and juries to weed out those claims without merit. And in many other areas of the law, they have that responsibility and they're even satisfied that responsibility.
But counsel, isn't that just a way of getting around 655? 655 has a whole series of procedural requirements and it has a series of damage limitations. And now all you're doing is pulling it out because... won't the damages for bad faith be the same as, at a minimum, the same as you get under 655 for bodily injury, and maybe more for punitive damages?
I would think that the elements of damage would be similar in that bad faith may provide you with more damages because of not being susceptible to caps, because of your ability to recover attorney's fees.
So it's a way out of 655, at least for certain organized HMOs.
In a small number of cases, it is possible that the same actions could serve as a basis for both a malpractice claim and a bad faith claim. But a bad faith claim is not a malpractice claim. The instruction shows there are different elements that would need to be proved under a bad faith claim, and merely because somebody is going to make that allegation doesn't mean they're going to be able to prove it and recover under it.
Just establish this question.
I don't think you were complete a couple minutes ago. I don't think you completed your sentence. Because it sounded to me like you were starting to articulate a standard that we've been looking for. And you start off by saying, without a reasonable basis for denying the benefit. Do you recall that? That was maybe 2 minutes ago, and I thought you said there were two...
And I was trying to pull the language as best I could recall it from the pattern 2761 instruction.
Of the insurance.
Right.
And that's what instruction again?
2761.
Okay.
A bad faith by insurance company assures claim. And I believe the standard there is that the HMO in this case... made a referral decision that was, or made a decision on benefits, made a decision to refer on benefits that was negligent, so to speak, or contrary to the contract, and knew or should have known that its failure to refer was contrary to the contract. So you have actually a higher step because in medical negligence, you just have to show negligence. In this case, you'd have to show a failure to provide benefits, the referral under the contract, but you'd also have to show they knew or should have known of this failure to do that.
That's the standard instruction. You withdrawn the concept that the patient has to make a demand or that a particular doctor has to make a demand.
I believe now that showing up and asking for treatment under the policy is a demand sufficient enough to trigger...
That's what's left, right?
No, of course.
Thanks, counsel. Mr. Ritchie.
A couple of points that I'd like to address here in rebuttal. Under Chapter 655, it's important for a healthcare cooperative. They do, in fact, pay malpractice premiums into the patient's compensation fund as well as to their own malpractice carrier. So when somebody comes in and says that the course of treatment that you're providing, this outpatient treatment program, is insufficient, that should trigger their protection under the patient's compensation fund as well as their malpractice coverage. If it's a bad faith claim, it may very well be that they're there with no coverage.
Mr. Ritchie, everybody seems to accept the concept that when you're dealing with an insurance contract, because of the special relationship that exists between the insured and the insurer, that if the insurer says, look, I'm not going to pay this claim because we can't afford it, and acts in bad faith, that you can sue him for bad faith. Now, so far, well, why shouldn't that, let's forget Chapter 65, just as a matter of public policy, why shouldn't that same standard apply in this kind of a parallel, what I believe to be a very parallel situation? So far what I've heard is it only applies to insurance companies and therefore we can't do it. I'd like to know why. I don't want to hear the answer that I heard 55 years ago, because that's the way we've always done it.
Well, there's two things that go with that. First off, you had asked earlier, where do we draw that line between malpractice and when it spills over into bad faith? First of all, when you're talking about bad faith, that assumes that there is malpractice, and you have to prove malpractice to get to the bad faith. When you allege a bodily injury, the bodily injury is because of the malpractice, not because of bad faith. The decision that was made was malpractice. That's where the bodily injury comes from. Whether it's in good faith or in bad faith, that decision is what caused the injury. Whether you made it with ill will didn't cause the injury, but the malpractice did the decision. So when you look at what is it that you're claiming, if you're claiming a bodily injury, then you are claiming malpractice. If you're looking for some sort of punitive damages, that may be arising from bad faith, but you should not be able to get a bodily injury damages as a result of a bad faith claim. In essence, people are leapfrogging them and just skipping.
So you admit that malpractice can consist of either a negligent act done in good faith, or it can consist of an intentional or reckless disregard act done in bad faith. Nevertheless, it's always medical malpractice and nothing more.
That's right.
Counsel, as explained previously, the more popular HMO is non-staff HMO. Is it possible to have a malpractice claim against a non-staff